Mother. You're alive.
Too bad.
You will die.
Your Goose is Cooked. Uncut Print Film Podcast, episode 39. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Internet. Welcome to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 39. I'm Jeff Rollins, or you could call me Golden Eagle. Or Eagle.
Oh, hi there. I'm Dave Costel. I forget the other nicknames he has.
That's it.
You only got two. I'm Chris Evangelista. I have no nicknames.
I took all the nicknames. And we are a film podcast.
That's right.
Who's Phil?
No, not Phil. No, film. The medium... The artistic medium of film.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
We talk about movies, in other words, and actors and directors and all that stuff.
All that fun stuff.
Yes, we love film. We just can't stop talking about film.
That's it. Someone help us, please. It's a condition.
Not to be confused with cut print straight to TV, which is a totally different thing.
Yeah, I don't even know what we're talking about. Yeah. That's how different that is.
So, hey, everyone, if you're feeling particularly randy tonight, why not go to iTunes and give this podcast a 5-star review?
And you can say, boy, those guys are really funny. They tickle me in all the right spots.
Or go to Twitter and tweet, hey, at Cutprint Film, I wish you didn't watch this Mel Brooks movie you're going to talk about tonight.
Yes, that is true. We watched Mel Brooks' History of the World Part 1, and we're going to get to that later.
Yes.
But first, two very big movies came out this week. Oh.
What's happening?
Well, Dave's just blowing out everyone's speakers.
That was a bad idea.
I was doing the Hunger Games thing.
Oh.
Oh, that's right. The Hunger Games. Mockingjay Part 1.
Do they whistle terribly into a microphone in that film?
Have you never seen a Hunger Games movie?
I haven't, actually. I'm the one weirdo who has yet to see these films.
They do a whistle thing, but I don't know what notes or keys or any of that stuff is, so I can't do it.
It's a dog whistle, I think they use.
It's a brown note.
And then they hold their fingers up like this.
Yeah, three
which is
fingers.
Like, kind of like Hitler is.
Yeah, saying like this is a great medium for radio, by the way, for podcasting.
And I did it, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 1. Dave, you saw it.
Not to be confused with History of the World Part 1, which is a totally different thing.
Don't you dare confuse it. One's probably good.
Do they sing that Mockingbird song in the film? Like, mock. Yeah.
No, they don't.
Jay.
Oh.
No.
Bird. Part 1. Movie.
What's happening?
Just keeps going.
So it was very good. I enjoyed it.
I've seen a lot of people say the fact that they broke it into two films makes this film like all set up and no payoff. What do you, Dave Costell, have to say about that?
Okay, well,
what's Costell's take?
Costell's cakes. Sweet.
Delicious.
I will say this, the cash grab tactic is one of the most infuriating things on planet.
Oh, I'm sick of it. Please stop breaking movies into two parts, please.
And I'm actually more sick of it when it comes to TV final series.
Oh, that's
where
the
split
worst.
It out
yeah.
over.
Like Mad Men. They aired the first season last year, and then they're going to wait till
they don't mess around with that type of stuff on Glad Men.
Those guys are just having a great time.
Taking the trash out.
They do 24 episode seasons, too. All right. Enough with that
joke.
Sorry,
I've derailed everything.
So it is a lot of setup, but for me, that translated to tension.
Yeah.
Like, because it's just building. It's build. What's the word I'm looking for? Coincidentally.
Legos?
In the same way kind of Foxcatcher does, where it's just, you just feel it building the whole time mm-hmm. towards, because you know what's coming.
Right.
With Hunger Games, you know it's going to end, and you're going to be like, oh.
They're finally going to eat something. Yeah. And they're like, oh, thank God those Hunger Games are over.
That was so worth it.
But it was cool. It stepped out of the games mode, which I don't know if either of you have ever seen the Hunger Games 1 and 2.
I saw the first one.
I already said I didn't. So.
I didn't love the first one, so I skipped the second one because the second one was my least favorite book.
When it started to get popular, I sort of wrote it off because I was like, oh, that's just Battle Royale for teens, basically.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah.
Read that sentiment a lot.
I tried doing that, but then I got into it. The first one was decent enough where I was like, oh, this is interesting because I wasn't expecting... I was expecting... Right. On the heels of Twilight, I was expecting something atrocious.
Right, more teen garbage.
So Catching Fire is a better movie than the first one.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard that. And the trailers for this one looked really good. They looked exciting.
And because this steps out of the games platform, it has more of a chance to build on the sci-fi world that it's in, which I found interesting because I love world building.
Yeah.
And it's cool because it pays homage to some classic sci-fi movies, most notably Aliens, which is cool.
Really?
A lot of this takes place in an underground bunker because they're hiding out from the Capitol. So it kind of felt like that spaceship in Alien because everything's confined.
Right.
And the lighting is the same. It's like that orange and black and blue lighting constantly. Right. There's even like a thing where there's a... not a self-destruct countdown, but the blast doors are going to close.
Okay, right.
So they're going through that thing while they're being bombed, and it's like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
That reminded me of the scene in Aliens
at the end.
Which cuts right into a scene where she's watching them go Zero Dark 30 style into the Capitol, which was blatantly, like, I was like, oh, this is... Zero Dark 30.
Was Chris Pratt there with his abs?
But to add tension to it, Katniss is watching it on a screen the same way in Aliens that Ripley watches them,
right.
Their head cams. And then there's a third thing added to that, which is they're trying to distract the Capitol by this dude Finnick reading a broadcast.
Man, they have great names in this movie. And by great names, I mean I hate them all.
Well, don't be finicky about this.
Plutarch Heavensby.
Oh, Jesus.
Hi, I'm a real person.
The names are very, like, deliberately trying to be...
Yeah, it's like, oh, what sounds like a sci-fi name?
Yeah.
Katniss. Because, like, they almost sound like real names, but not.
Gorgel Flirtenstein.
Engelbert Humperdinck, I believe, is a character in this film.
Katniss, I mean, I kind of like that name, so that works for me, but all the other names, PETA.
Oh,
I
get the fuck out of
that's
there.
That's a type of bread.
Yeah, and he's a baker, so that kind of is annoying.
Oh, now I'll never see this movie now. How is Philip Seymour Hoffman? Because this is the last time we're going to see him in anything
Well,
new.
He'll be in the next one.
Is he going to be in the next one? Okay.
Because they filmed these back-to-back.
Right.
And
I didn't know if his character dies in this or what. I don't know enough about it. I don't know if you want to give it away or anything.
Yeah, well, he has an overdose halfway through the movie.
That's depressing. Really, you brought us all down.
I'm sorry. So I have this deep connection with Philip Seymour Hoffman. So again, this is like,
well, he was a great actor.
It's depressing, but I guess this first scene might have been filmed out of continuity because the first time you see him on screen, he looks awful.
Really?
It's a scene where he's sitting there with Julianne Moore and Katniss, and they're just sitting at a table, and he just looks miserable. His face, like, he's delivering his lines very blandly.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is gonna be bad. Like, I'm watching a dead man walking.
Right.
But then later he has like way more energy in the later scenes.
Yeah,
and
it was just like a bad day on set for him.
So he's great in it.
Right.
I mean, he's not fantastic.
Right.
And he's not even in it that much. So
so
maybe that's why. But when he's on screen, you're like, this is better than if it had been like.
Yeah,
I don't think
I don't think he ever delivered a bad performance, even in terrible movies. So
even in Pirate Radio.
Yeah.
So this was a good movie.
Yeah,
because very good. Like Chris said, it's getting mixed reviews.
Yeah, it's not getting the best reviews. Well,
I thought the action worked. Even that scene, you've probably seen the trailer ad nauseum, but the scene where she shoots down the
with the arrow, that's cool looking in the trailer.
It builds to that in the scene, and even after seeing it 15 times, it still excited me in the movie, which I was surprised because shit that gets spoiled in trailers for me, it does nothing for me in the movie. Like, for example, the tidal wave in Interstellar.
Yeah.
Like, I had no feelings when that happened.
Right.
And coincidentally killed the Hunger Games man.
Oh, yes. Yes, it did. Old swirly beard.
But with
himself.
This, it worked. And I was like, okay, so they're doing something right because I had an emotional response to something I've already seen 45 times on
TV.
That's
good, then.
Yeah. A lot of the criticism for this is that it is split into two parts.
It's all set up.
They're saying that nothing happens in this, but you say it builds tension. And I mean,
things happen.
It made $35 million less than Catching Fire did.
Oh, wow.
But I read an article about specifically about breaking movies into different parts.
Was that Matt Singer's
piece? Yeah, it was Matt Singer's piece on Screen Crush. And he said that Harry Potter, Deathly Hallows Part 1, that also made about $50 million less than Part 2 did.
Yeah, because it sort of robs that excitement of, like, I got to rush out and see this.
Right, and so, well, $50 million worth of people said, I'll just wait for the second one and see all the action. And I think that's by no means do I think that this $35 million dip is going to mean anything next year when Part 2 comes out. I think people will be out in droves.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not an action junkie, though, so this...
Oh,
yeah.
He loves burgers.
But I don't know. The breaking it up is annoying, but it feels like because there's almost no plot twists in the first half.
Yeah.
And it feels like there has to be in the second half. I've never read the book, so I don't know what's going to happen next. But it feels like there's got to be something major, because what else could they do?
Right.
Are they just going to attack the Capitol in the second movie? That would be boring as fuck.
Yeah.
So I hope that they don't just do that.
Guess we'll find out next year.
Yes. Come back this time next year when we would discuss.
That surprised me. I thought it was going to be one of those March, May releases.
March Madness?
Yeah.
The NCAA tournament, the
Sweet 16.
Yeah, like I feel like I wouldn't mind broken up movie like this if they released the second one like a few months later,
like Kill Bill.
Yeah, if it was just like, you know, one came out now and then one came out in March, I'd be
like,
I feel like
they did that with something else too. Maybe was it Harry Potter that they released December?
I can't remember.
Maybe it was the hot. No, I know. I don't know.
We'll never
Might have
know.
Been White Chicks Part 1.
Oh yeah, that's what it was. All right. I think that's enough Hunger Games talk.
Yeah, let's talk.
We're all very thirsty.
Hungry. Well, if you're hungry, why don't you take a bite out of this fox's back? I just caught it. Do you hear what I'm doing? I'm segueing into Foxcatcher.
I'll be leaving now.
Fine, go, Chris.
Yeah, I'll stick around.
You're going to miss all the good conversation.
All the great segues to come.
All right, so Foxcatcher. It's being released slowly, limited.
It's getting one of those pathetic... comes out a different place
every
week.
It's like a Tylenol PM.
Extended release.
Yeah, and I think it's in something like 25 theaters across the country right now. And Philadelphia, which is our region, was lucky enough to get Foxcatcher this weekend in one theater.
Yes, in one theater.
So, you know, we all saw it. Dave saw it earlier because he did the review
a little while ago.
But let's get into this. Foxcatcher.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's roll up our cuffs.
It's directed by Bennett Miller, who did Capote and Moneyball.
Yeah.
And it stars Channing Tatum, Steve Carell, Mark Ruffalo, Sienna Miller.
Oh, she's really good in this. I'm just kidding.
It's a very tight cast.
It is. It's it's a small cast. It's a small movie.
Yeah, there's not a lot of characters because it didn't need them. Vanessa Redgrave is in it.
And she's really good for the three scenes she's in.
Yeah, for the very brief amount of time we see her.
Should I run through a plot synopsis?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Foxcatcher tells the story of Olympic gold medal winning wrestler Mark Schultz, played by Channing Tatum, who sees a way out from the shadow of his more celebrated brother, Dave, played by Mark. I'm reading the synopsis, Dave. Played by his... played by Mark Ruffalo, and a life of poverty when he is summoned by eccentric multi-millionaire John DuPont, played by Steve Carell, to move on to his estate and train for the 1988 Seoul Olympics. Desperate to gain the respect of his disapproving mother, DuPont begins, quote-unquote, coaching a world-class athletic team and, in the process, lures Mark into dangerous habits, breaks his confidence, and drives him into a self-destructive spiral. Based on actual events, Foxcatcher is a gripping and profoundly American story of fragile men who pinned their hopes for love and redemption on a desperate obsession for greatness that was to end in tragedy.
Did you write that yourself?
Absolutely not. I will not take credit for that garbage.
Some say these men wrestle with deep issues.
Okay, so.
Some say they're on DuPont.
Wow, that stunk, Dave.
In DuPont.
I'd like you to stop.
Please.
Okay, so.
I'm going to keep saying DuPont. Got Fox a big Catcher. Laugh last time.
Foxcatcher, very serious movie. Yeah.
Yes.
Very serious.
Okay, so you said something interesting, that it's a small movie, but it didn't feel small to me. This felt very wide and expansive.
Well, that's because all the shots are wide.
Yeah, this is.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, that was an interesting thing, and it's a correct thing to say that it was a small movie, but
But it's shot like a big movie. It's shot like a big, important movie, but it's only starring essentially three men.
Yeah.
And it's really about the performances. No, not three men and a baby. This is three men and a little lady.
Yeah.
And that little lady, what's her name?
Wrestling.
Wrestles.
Yes. Her name's Wrestling. So, yeah. This is basically about the performances.
This film.
I would say the cinematography in this is great.
It's beautiful.
An awesome looking movie.
But first and foremost, it's the performances because there's three leading men. I mean, you can say what you will about who the real star is. In the end, I don't think Bennett Miller even knew who this movie was about. But I think the lion's share is
the fox's share.
The fox's share is shared between the three of them.
Yes. All right. So, what did we all think of Foxcatcher? Let's do a little round the room,
round robin.
Yeah.
Go.
We're gonna wrestle.
Yeah, we're gonna wrestle, and then.
All right. So I went into this not as excited as other people. I know Chris was really looking forward to this.
I was
one.
Very excited for this.
I actually reluctantly went into this. And it, in the first 20 minutes, I was like, oh, I'm not really feeling this movie.
Right.
Looking back on it, I do enjoy the first 20 minutes. But at the time, I was like, this is weird. There's something about this that isn't what I expected at all.
Right.
But once John DuPont comes into the scene, like it, the movie.
Once JonBenet Ramsey comes into this, is that what you're going to say?
The movie kind of shifts into gear. And right.
Absolutely.
It doesn't. I wouldn't say it changes tone, but it starts going somewhere.
Yeah, it becomes more alive when he shows up.
Yeah, and but those early scenes, specifically the first scene with Channing Tatum, who has the most ridiculous name on planet Earth, and Mark Ruffalo, when they're doing that, like, because you don't know they're brothers yet. I guess you do if you know
the story, you know. Yeah. But
like in that wrestling routine that they do. You get that they're brothers, and I thought that was really impressive.
Right. I thought that was – I loved that scene.
Yeah.
It comes about 5 minutes into the film, and in the 5 minutes preceding that, there's not a whole lot of dialogue spoken. There's hardly any. Channing Tatum speaks to a class of children, and that's about it.
Yeah.
There's almost no dialogue, and then he goes into this wrestling room, and Mark Ruffalo's there, and they just start sparring, essentially, and you can – get from the physicality of that scene just what the dynamic of that relationship is. You can tell that one of them has these like pent-up aggressions and the other one is the more nurturing one because he gets Mark Ruffalo gets a headbutt to the nose and just kind of shakes it off and it goes right back in because his job in that moment is to train Channing Tatum
is
to get him ready for the world's
it
championship.
It almost felt like two bears.
Yeah, it looked like two bears. Because this is heavyweight wrestling. This is not welterweight
this
or
isn't, no. lightweight. Or Bam Bam Bigelow. Or. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, it's not like high school wrestlers where like they're thin and wiry. These are heavyweights. These guys are muscular. So it honestly looks like two bears.
Yeah.
What did you think, Chris?
So, yeah, like Dave said, I went into this with high expectations. I thought this was going to be, for me, one of the best movies of the year. And I'm not going to say I liked this movie. It is a good movie, but I was very disappointed with the film. Like Dave, the first 20 minutes of the film, I was like, oh, I kind of don't like this movie at all. What's going on? And I eventually got more in line with it. And the performances are phenomenal. All three of them, Carell, Ruffalo, and Tatum, they're all great. There's a lot of great physicality to all three. Like Tatum walks through he has a sort of like gait. The way he walks.
He walks like every wrestler I've ever seen in high school walk.
He walks like a gorilla.
Yeah,
and like and just the way Mark Ruffalo carries himself, you can just tell like just the way his body language, you can tell just what like a nice nurturing guy he is.
And he has these eyes that just show friendliness and warmth to them.
And then
in every scene.
And then Carell, know how he did that. He must actually be nice.
And like Carell has the perfect. I've seen some criticisms of Carell's performance that it's too much of a performance. That it's too much of him. It's too much of like tics and acting. But I really didn't get this. I felt it was a really. I won't say natural, but it was a believable performance. And I was never distracted by it. And I've seen people also say like they're distracted by the fake nose he wears. Not once was I distracted by that.
No, it looks entirely real.
It looks looks like it should be there.
Beyond the nose, his skin looks
beyond the mat.
Yes, beyond the mat. Wrestling with Shadows, Hitman Hart. His skin has this papery.
He looks like a corpse, basically.
It's like liver spotty.
It looks like his skin looks like vellum paper.
Yeah.
And Jean DuPont looked horrible.
How he looks in this film is how if Christopher Nolan ever used the penguin in his films is how would look like this. That's basically how it would look.
That's a good analogy.
And like, and I'm sure it was intentional because his character is like a, how do you pronounce it, ornithologist.
Ornithologist.
He studies birds, so they give him this sort of like bird.
He's a philatelist, which is a stamp collector.
That's a great, I like that scene. But performances aside, there's just something, I felt the film was lacking. It had a very distinct lack of energy, I felt. And I felt like it needed, and I don't think Bennett Miller is a bad director. I just feel like he's the wrong man for this film. Like, I felt like if David Fincher had directed this film, it would have been like a knockout. It would have been like one of my favorite films of the year. But I felt like Bennett Miller doesn't have a distinct style. He doesn't really have his own sort of...
I'm going to disagree with you and then agree with you.
Okay.
First, I like the fact that it's sort of empty and...
Right.
It's soulless.
Exactly. You're right. That is the word to use. It's a soulless-looking film, and I feel like that works because both Mark Schultz and Jean DuPont are lacking. There's something lacking in them, and I think the film, because it's so soulless, it does a great job of highlighting the fact that these two characters are, they're not necessarily two sides of the same coin, but they're both coveting something that the other has. Mark Schultz is pretty much impoverished,
right,
and he wants to be great. He wants to be recognized for his greatness like the DuPonts are. And Jean DuPont has everything in the world. He's never been told no except by his mother. And what he covets is a wrestling championship or some type of trophy of his own that he earned. And I think because they're both so sorely desiring these things, it's eaten away at them inside, and they're empty. They're just husks.
They're like two vampires feeding on each other.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, and that's why I think the soullessness of the film works, because it is definitely soulless.
It's and I like cold movies, but this movie it's too cold.
It's like staring into the abyss.
It needed it just needed something, because like even though Mark Ruffalo's character is a warm character, it's not enough. It doesn't break that ice. It's too fucking cold.
Honestly, let me get to the part where I agree with you.
Yes, please do, because that's my favorite part.
I do agree that perhaps Bennett Miller was not the right man for the job.
And again, I don't think he's a bad director. I just feel like he's not...
I don't think he has enough signature of his own.
He doesn't.
Capote... That was a very sterile film as well.
But I like that film. Even though that movie, one thing Bennett Miller does is he does coldness well, because Capote is a cold movie, but I didn't feel...
Yes, it is.
I didn't feel like it was lacking what this film was lacking.
With Moneyball, that's just a pretty much... That's a generic film.
Yeah.
That has almost...
Okay.
No signature to it, you know what I mean? And nothing against Bennett Miller, like you said.
He's not a bad director. It's just something's missing. maybe that's just the way maybe he's just a naturally cold guy, that's why he makes movies like this.
We're only a few films in for him, so I can't really... there's not much to draw from.
Yeah. So I will say that while I think Foxcatcher is a good movie, I wanted to love this movie, and I didn't. And this isn't really a flaw of the movie, but this is such a quiet movie that seeing this with a full audience is like fucking Chinese water torture.
Oh, I loved it.
Oh, God, no, because audiences are monsters. I saw this with a packed house, and first of all, the movie is deliberately quiet, and for the first like half hour of the movie, I kept hearing people in the theater being like, I can't hear what's going on. Like, it's a quiet movie. Stop it. And then this woman next to me, for some reason, she brought fucking Werther's original individually wrapped candy. So she just kept unwrapping every single one and popping into her mouth. And so I just heard that over and over. And I just... So that shit
crash.
Drives me
you
nuts.
You had a really bad crowd. Yeah.
That's not the movie's fault, but it's just like, it sort of ruined the experience for me. That was just,
I had such a great experience. Like, so I was center row.
Well, you saw it with critics.
Yeah, I was essentially by myself, just the whole screen.
Yeah,
and my,
yeah, Dave went to a 10 a.m. critic screening, which are heaven on earth. Yeah. So,
well, my wife and I, we went to the same exact theater you went to, right. Chris, the day before, and we had a great crowd. Everybody was silent. And for me, it not only was the theater experience, but also the first 10 minutes of pretty much silence of this film reminded me of when I saw There Will Be Blood. And I think that got the gears going in my head of really enjoying this film. I loved Foxcatcher.
See, now that you say There Will Be Blood, I want like Paul Thomas Anderson to have directed that movie. Movie, it would have been a million times better.
I totally disagree with the Fincher thing, but Paul Thomas Anderson.
Why do you disagree with the Fincher thing? Because he's a cold director.
Because Fincher has like a snappiness to him, and I said this to you before, but like has like a comedic energy that
I
wouldn't want in this.
When
film.
I say Fincher, I'm thinking of the Fincher who directed The Game, because The Game. It has the same tone as this. It's, and it also has that same sort of tinkling piano score where it's like a few piano notes being hit. And it's that the game has the same sort of lack of energy and snappiness, but that movie feels more lively to me than this.
There is comedy in this, but it's uncomfortable comedy. Yeah. There's a scene where John DuPont is getting drunk with this team of wrestlers.
Oh, God.
And he deliberately wrestles them.
He's wrestling them, and they have to like succumb to him and submit because it's his house, and he's the coach, and he's the quadrillionaire. And it's just he's hammered drunk, and he's just tackling them at the legs, and they have to fall down, and then they have to let him pin them. And these are hulking men.
Yeah.
It's just really uncomfortable.
There's a lot of like,
and it's
like,
goofy funny, but it's really uncomfortable.
There's a lot of like gay subtext in the. There's one scene in particular where,
well, we get frosted tips, and we know where frosted tips come from.
There's one scene in particular where
that's where it kind of started to feel like Boogie Nights.
Yeah. there's one scene where. John DuPont comes to Mark. Mark's living at the. It's Mark, right? Dave is Mark Ruffalo's character. It's confusing because Mark Ruffalo's name is Mark. Yeah. And this, anyway, so John DuPont comes to Mark's French chalet at night, and he's like, "Oh, let's go practice." And they're practicing in the gallery of the mansion, and it's pitch black, and you only see them laying on the ground, like humping each other, and it's like. Oh, this is upsetting me,
and once you see the frosted tips and the cut off sweatpants shorts, you know where this relationship is headed. I don't think it ever gets there.
And to clarify, I'm not saying there's something creepy about being gay.
No,
that's not what I'm saying.
It's like a horrifying tone.
There's something creepy about John DuPont. Is what you're saying. You can tell where this relationship would have headed if. Channing Tatum.
Yeah.
If Mark Schultz. Didn't, what's the word?
Withdraw himself
from the entire situation. Like I said, frosted tips, you know where we're headed from there.
I'll agree. Like, there's only one true comedic scene, and it's the scene in the helicopter when they're...
I think there's a few other scenes. The scene where he says, like, call me Eagle is fucking deliberately funny.
I didn't think that was... That felt, like, so sad to me.
I still think it's
a sadness over everything.
I still think it's played a little
Those
bit
felt like
laughs.
Michael Scott moments, which I... Like,
there's a lot of Michael Scott character.
Even, like, the British Office, like, that kind of cringe humor. Like, that was, like...
The David Brent?
Yeah.
See, I got more Michael Scott out of this because there's a sadness to Michael Scott, even though he's a goofball.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. These could have been, like, the same person just going in total different directions.
Michael Scott is a pathetic character who doesn't know he's pathetic, and that's what John DuPont is in this film. He doesn't know how...
Emotionally...
And he doesn't, and like, there's
damaged
a,
he is.
There's a really, this scene is also, I think, played for laughs, but also upsetting where he, after his mother basically just says, like, oh, wrestling is a low sport. She hates wrestling. He makes her nurse wheel her into a practice.
Oh, God.
And he just makes his mother watch him. Coach. Do these pathetic wrestling moves.
Rudimentary, what are they, arm bars and gut wrenches.
Yeah, I don't think that was played for laughs.
I think it's supposed
really
to be a little bit funny.
I agree with Chris. I think it's supposed to
it's
be...
It's supposed to be darkly humorous. It's not like a laugh out loud sort of thing.
Yeah, that is a very upsetting
And she
scene.
eventually just makes her nurse wheel her away.
But that scene also gets us to see, yet again, what a great, friendly person Dave Schultz is because he picks up on this and says, all right, guys, we're going to do arm bars and gut wrenches now.
Yeah, he just acts like he's in charge. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He lets DuPont know. All
acts
right,
like DuPont's in charge.
You're the boss. Yeah. That's what we're doing. And I don't know. I think that scene not only serves to show how damaged this relationship between mother and son is, it also shows what a great person Dave Schultz was.
And there's,
and that's the ultimate goal, is to build up this character, only to, spoiler, see him gunned down at the end.
There's a my favorite scene in this movie is after John DuPont's mother dies. It cuts to him. John DuPont's mother loves horses, and she was like a equestrian, and she was a champion of horse, whatever the fuck it's called.
I don't know what that's called.
So
she's an equestrian.
Yeah,
we'll leave it.
She's an aquarium, and
I don't know what that's called.
So
it has a name, because I know the Romneys do it.
Yeah, I think it's called white people sports. Yeah. Anyway, so she dies, and it cuts to John DuPont in the stables, and he just lets all of her horses go, and just. He just basically lets them run away wild into the mist, and that was my that scene.
That's a gorgeous scene, and that goes back to Dave with the cinematography. This film is beautiful.
All those shots
looking.
Of Valley Forge, it's like,
and this takes place right in our backyard in Pennsylvania, and it's almost hard not to have beautiful shots of the Pennsylvania countryside. Right. It's a gorgeous piece of land.
And speaking of Pennsylvania, my other favorite part of this film is how accurately Steve Carell adapts the Philly accent.
Oh, that hideous Philly accent.
So there's a part, anytime he says the word coach, he says it as coach, and that's the
that is accurate.
That's the terribly accurate Philly accent coming through, and I loved that. So
after the Phil's game, we're gonna go down and do some wrestling. we'll grab a couple cokes and
a hoagie.
Do we want to take a break and come back and wrap up Fox Catcher?
We'll wrap up Meet the Fockers,
and then we'll jump on to History of the World.
All right. See you in a minute. Or an hour.
I hope not. Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutPrintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
CutPrint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do! It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons.
I'm Alan Rothenberg, the injury lawyer.
Oh, yeah. Hey, all you sexy ladies out there. And
all those sexy foxes.
You know you are sweet little.
We're talking Foxcatcher.
Foxy.
On the Cutprint Film Podcast. You're listening to Cutprint Film FM.
Dude, I really want one of those sweatshirts, though.
Team Foxcatcher.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're nice. That's going to be the next Team Zisu.
You think so?
Oh, yeah.
We should start selling them in the Cutprint Film store, then.
Yeah, that doesn't exist. So let's talk about the murder in the film. Would you guys say this film is almost like a true crime film?
Definitely.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Foxcatcher is brought to you by MailChimp.
MailChimp?
Oh. MailChimp. For your emails and high fives.
I'm just going to let this play out the rest of the show. Is that all right?
Sounds good to me.
I can't turn it down, so you have to.
Anyway, so
the ending of Foxcatcher, you know what it's building to. You know there's a murder.
I will say that the audience I saw it with fucking was shocked when this murder happened. It's a shocking scene, but
I heard some gasps.
My wife.
I heard some ghosts.
My wife actually didn't know the full story. You heard some ghosts?
I didn't know the full story.
So she was she jumped in her seat when it happened. And I actually. I don't know if you guys remember it, but I actually remember being on the news because it was on the local news. And I remember like the news vans outside the mansion and stuff like that when he got arrested.
I have a vague memory of it. And going into the film, I knew that he was murdered, but I purposely didn't read up on it because I wanted to, you know, just kind of let this film narrative take me along the way it wanted to.
So
I was surprised I didn't know about it because My one of my grandfathers is like a big wig at DuPont Chemical. So I figured some point in my childhood I would have heard about it, but
yeah.
But I didn't. I knew someone died.
Yeah.
That's all I knew. I didn't know how it would happen, what was going to happen.
So it's a very sudden scene. And my question is, from a thematic purpose, is it too sudden? Is it too out of nowhere? It's literally like, even though we can tell something is wrong with John DuPont, it's never hinted that he's about to kill someone ever in the film. So I wonder, from a thematic standpoint, if it's too sudden.
I discussed a shift of... a sudden shift to you, and I wasn't talking about the murder when I said that. The rift for me that's too sudden is the way Mark Schultz starts to withdraw suddenly, because there's no specific event that triggers that.
And I will say, I read an interview with Bennett Miller, where the first cut of this film was 4 hours and 12 minutes long.
Not long enough in my book.
So
I need more wrestling.
So I'm sure a lot of stuff got cut, and I feel like that sort of hurt the film a little bit.
It is sudden, but I like that it's sudden.
No, it's effective.
Because
it's
an end cap on the movie, too. It's pretty much the final scene.
Yeah.
I think a big problem with that whole, just basically the way the events play out in this film, they're cut for time. This stuff took place over about 10 years.
Yeah.
And in the film, it kind of feels like it plays out
3 years,
about 36 months.
It barely felt like a year to me.
Yeah. So all this stuff happens in over 10 years. So that turning point of Mark Schultz, withdrawing from the whole Foxcatcher Farms program, that probably took months and months and months in real life, but in this, it's just a day and night thing.
Yeah.
And Dave Schultz and John DuPont were actually friends, because they had a working relationship for years.
Yeah.
But in the film, it doesn't play that way.
Yeah,
for a few months.
Yeah, it seems like they barely know each other.
So yeah, this film starts in 1986, right after the 86 Olympics.
Yeah.
So I guess it would start in 87.
Yeah, I think they're writing a check at the beginning, and they write 87 on the check.
Right. And John DuPont shot Dave Schultz in 1996.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But you don't get that from the film.
You don't.
And part of that is a problem, because just like you said, it's almost like, what? Why are these people all of a sudden changing the way they're acting? But part of it I kind of like, because the film can tell its own story and it's not dependent upon 1988, 1989 flashing on the screen.
That would be too much, yeah. And
it kind of works, though, because you get the scene, which is an amazing scene, of when Mark Ruffalo's shooting the documentary and the guy's kind of trying to get him to say
he's his
fake
mentor.
Things.
Yeah. John DuPont is his
and
mentor.
You could tell how painful it is for him.
But he's a savvy guy, and he does it.
Yeah.
He says, John DuPont's a
he
mentor
He says it in a
mine.
Very, like,
he says
pained way.
He's kind of my mentor.
Yeah. But then the scene right before the murder is John DuPont watching that documentary, and it seems like that kind of triggers it. It's like him watching that and thinking about how Dave wouldn't cooperate with it. Almost seems like that builds to the murder.
Yeah.
In the narrative of the movie, I'm saying.
There's a scene, and I didn't know all the details. There's a scene where John DuPont shows up at the house where, what the fuck's the character? Dave, right? I keep getting them mixed up.
Yeah.
So where the Dave character is, he's playing in the leaves with his daughters, and John DuPont's wearing a Civil War coat.
With sweatpants.
And I thought that, because I knew enough about the murder that it happened in a driveway, and I thought that was going to be the murder scene.
Oh,
so
his kids there?
Yeah, and so I was a little taken aback by that, because even though it's it's sort of amusing that you can tell John DuPont's going crazy, it was sort of just there.
I like that
scene.
And
he tells him, it's Sunday, John.
He's like, it's family time.
And that is just a nail in through the heart of somebody whose mother was so cold that she actually paid somebody to be his friend when he was a boy.
That's an upsetting scene where he tells that story.
And this is just an emotionally damaged character, this John DuPont. It's a fascinating character, and I think Steve Carell does a wonderful job.
Oh, absolutely.
One thing I read, I thought it was a very interesting point, is that throughout the entire film, Carell has his head tilted back at about a 45-degree angle, and he's always looking down that enormous nose at everybody, whereas Channing Tatum, he's kind of constantly looking up over this enormous furrowed brow.
Yeah.
And it's a great dynamic of those
two
characters.
Foil of them.
It's just fantastic.
Yeah, the level of just physicality of the characters is fantastic.
Three masterful performances.
Right.
But I feel like a lot of that could be because of Bennett Miller, you know
think
what I mean?
So?
Him paying attention to detail and just the way the film lines up thematically with these big American tropes and that, it just worked for me. It all came together.
Again, I don't think Bennett Miller is a bad director. I just feel like he just is missing something that could have made this film better.
I have a feeling this might win Best Picture.
I'd be shocked if it did. Honestly,
I can't think of anything else that would win over it.
Well,
do you mean quality wise or bullshit academy wise?
I'm just thinking academy.
I'm sure something like Theory of Everything will win, which is a terrible movie.
That has no chance of winning.
I actually saw that movie. No, I didn't.
No.
I guess The Imitation Game. That's what I'm thinking.
We'll find out. It'll get nominated and Carell will get nominated. I think Carell will win Best Actor probably.
Really?
I think so. I don't know if they're going to push him for Best Actor or Best Supporting Actor, because he's not actually the main focus of the film.
Yeah, Channing Tatum's the star.
Yeah, I would say Channing Tatum is more the lead in this.
And he even carries himself as the star of the film. Yeah. But then he disappears 3/4 of the way into the film.
Yeah, and I feel like that's the problem with the editing, too, that he just moves out, and I don't know.
My only issue with the film is the wrestling, that it's not exciting.
There's not enough suplexes.
Yeah.
I'm just for somebody who doesn't know the rules of wrestling, it's tough to follow if, like, what you're watching is good or bad or...
Yeah,
or,
I could see that.
You know what I mean? And there's a lot of it in there.
Yeah, there's a lot of wrestling.
And I will say the other thing that really bothered me is Sienna Miller as Dave Schultz's wife. Not her performance. It's that they literally give her nothing to do. And
John.
And I'm sure that got cut from the 4-hour cut too, but she literally has one line where she says, "Hi, John," and then that she does nothing.
That is it.
She just stands there, and it's kind of like offensive. Like, oh, did she really do that little...
There's actually that good scene where Mark brings him into the hotel room.
That's the "Hi, John" scene.
Yeah, that's "Hi, John."
Oh, well, she says "Hi, John" later when they're playing and leaves.
Oh, okay. All right. So she says it twice.
Yeah.
Wow, that's...
knockout performance.
Really stretching her acting legs there.
So there you go, Foxcatcher.
Yep.
Yeah, we better get into Mel Brooks's. I almost said Mel Gibson.
No.
See, that's what I did last week.
We're not doing any Mel Gibson talk.
Not
all right,
this week.
Let me hit this.
Oh, no. Director series. With directors directing retrospective.
That's it. I think that's enough.
Lemons.
All right. Did everybody enjoy that?
Not me.
Can we hear it again?
No, please. All we're already pressed for time.
Okay, so... The reason we are...
10 minutes. Let's do this.
Yeah, we have 20 minutes to wrap up this show.
The reason we're going to spend very little time talking about Mel Brooks' History of the World Part 1 is because it's not very good at all.
It is not.
It is abysmal.
Can we even give a plot synopsis for this film?
I can.
All right.
The world.
Sort of. Okay, this is... Oh, where'd it go? Directed by Mel Brooks, starring Mel Brooks,
yes.
Gregory Hines, Madeline Kahn, Mary Margaret Humes, and a cameo by Dom DeLuise as a lunatic's Nero Caesar.
Yeah.
History of the Worlds. Mel Brooks produced, directed, wrote, and starred in this episodic comedy in the spirit of Monty Python.
If you say so.
Yeah. He was going for it. The film was divided into 5 sequences that play like blue-toned Eddie Cantor vaudeville sketches. The Dawn of Man, The Stone Age, The Spanish Inquisition, The Bible, and The Future. Also included is a Brooksian depiction of The Last Supper and a long-winded sequence about the French Revolution.
Oh, brother.
The film starts with a 2001 A Space Odyssey parody narrated by Orson Welles, in which a collection of 8 men learn to stand erect in more ways than one.
Wah, wah, wah. I feel like everyone should be saying waka, waka, waka every scene in this film.
Yeah, I'm not going to go through any more plot synopsis because we can just walk
Thank
through
God.
This film.
Basically, pick up a copy of Mad Magazine and you will be reading History of the World Part 1.
So yeah, this film opens with the Dawn of Man parody from 2001 A Space Odyssey, where man learns to stand and masturbate immediately, and all the 8 men masturbate themselves to death.
Man, this movie is wall-to-wall sex and dick jokes.
Nonstop.
Just galore.
Nonstop.
And,
sizes of dicks, sizes of boobs, just all over and over.
From there, we move on to the Bible, where Moses comes out from The mountaintop.
This scene is actually amusing.
This is an iconic scene. I'd say it's the most iconic scene of the whole film, where he drops that third tablet.
Yeah, he comes out with 15 commandments, and he drops one.
Ten commandments, and so on.
So,
and everybody has a good chuckle.
The film is off to a good start, because it's these brief little vignettes, if you will.
Yeah, and we're spending about 4 to 5 minutes here.
And I feel like if the entire film had been that, this would have been a successful film. But at some point, it slows down to tell longer stories, and that's where it suffers.
Oh. So we touched on this with Young Frankenstein, the way we appreciated that it wasn't just joke after joke after joke and focused on the story of Frankenstein. But it works for that because you're using a classic story that's
and you're turning it on its ear a little bit. And making light of some funny things about that story.
But boy, I could have just done hours of those skits because this story, you don't care. Yeah. You don't know who anybody is.
I don't care. I don't like anybody. I don't like these jokes.
Yeah, there's no. So this is from Roger Ebert's review. It's a brief little thing. He says, what is this bizarre grab bag? Is it a parody of old biblical, Roman, and French historical epics? Sometimes. Is it one-shot comedy review blackouts? Sometimes. Is it satire aimed at pompous targets? Sometimes. But most of the time, it's basically just expensive sets sitting around waiting for Brooks to do something funny in front of them.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's this movie in a nutshell. Yeah. He nailed it.
So, this is a bad movie, but I'm not going to say it's terrible, because... Again, I think back to Dumb and Dumber 2 from last week, where that's a atrocious comedy because it just filmed terribly. And as bad as the jokes in this film are, I still have to give credit to Mel Brooks for trying, because this film is well directed. Like, it looks like a movie. He goes all out for sets and costumes and
for what is essentially a series of 5 sketches.
Yeah.
The settings look great.
Yeah.
Dave hates the costumes.
God,
they're bad. They look cheap. I didn't think they were that bad.
I just watched. I just got finished watching Ben-Hur, and the costumes in that are better.
Yeah, but that's a real epic with, you know.
Yeah, but it was filmed almost 40 years before this.
Yeah, all right. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, these costumes are bad, but I do like the settings. I think... A lot of money was spent on these settings.
Yeah.
And
what year was this? History of the World?
70 or no, 80 something. I don't know. I don't have it written down. I couldn't even fucking be bothered.
I'll ask you questions you don't know the answer to. The only part of the movie I really enjoyed was Dom DeLuise.
Yeah, Dom DeLuise.
81.
Plays,
sorry to cut in.
Okay. So it was about 40 years.
Dom DeLuise plays Nero Caesar, and he's just a slob and a lunatic. It's great. He's just this mean. Maniacal
sloth
pig.
I
did not like him.
Really. No, really.
I hated the entire Roman section.
Oh, it's bad. It's real bad.
And last week I was praising Madeline Kahn to the high heavens. Man, I just wanted her to shut up in this movie.
She's not good. She's even crazier somehow in this film.
So my favorite part of the film is the Spanish Inquisition musical number, which Jeff does not like. But I
didn't like it either.
I think it's so. Bizarre and over the top, and it's so well stated. Like, I've never seen a film before where Jews are attached to a roulette wheel and they're pulled. Like, that's so crazy.
Watch The Reader.
The only time I laughed was when Mel Brooks at the end is like in the gallows and he comes out of the Iron Maiden. That made me laugh.
The Inquisition features this line, which I like. Here we go.
The Inquisition. Let's begin the Inquisition.
It's coming up.
We have a mission to convert the Jews.
Come on, that's fun. That people saying Jews, that's hilarious to me.
Yeah, I guess, but we had to wait for it so long. And that's what this whole movie is.
I start doing that on my parody songs?
Yeah, I'll play all the time. And I don't know. It just and then it ends with this huge Busby Berkeley musical number where nuns come out and they go in a pool and then the nuns form like a human menorah. That's so crazy. I love it.
If I'm not mistaken, don't rabbis get drowned?
Yeah, it's all this insane, anti-Semitic humor. And
I will say that it is
not historically accurate, though.
No, it's not. That's my main contention with the whole film. There's no history at all here. It is staged very well.
Yeah.
This was a hard thing to pull off, and I appreciate it.
And it's a catchy little stupid song.
I appreciate it.
So I like that scene.
But, man, this Spanish Inquisition scene comes after we spend approximately 17 hours in ancient Rome, and I am I'm mentally and emotionally drained. I have nothing in me. I'm John DuPont at this point. And then here comes this musical number that I don't appreciate at all because I'm so drained. And then right after that, because this is only about 4 minutes long,
yeah.
we go into the worst part of the whole film, which is essentially a retelling of the Man in the Iron Mask with the French Revolution.
Yeah.
It is abysmal.
I will say I'd rather watch this than Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette.
Oh, I would too. No. That stinks.
Okay, that makes two of you.
But, I mean, there were things I liked about it.
I have another sound clip.
I like when it ended.
I have another sound clip from the French Revolution part, which I also liked, and it's this.
Your Majesty, you look like the piss boy. And you look like a bucket of shit.
That's funny.
Okay. The whole concept of the piss boy it made me laugh.
So this basically, not only is it Man in Iron Mask, it's also like Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, where basically there's a guy who looks like someone in power. So Mel Brooks, he plays...
It's like Dave. The movie Dave.
Oh, I thought you meant R. Dave.
No.
Yeah, it's...
I don't look like Hitler.
Starring Kevin Kline.
So what is it, Louis the 13th? I'm sorry, I can't get the history.
It's King Louis from the Jungle Book.
He
wants the power of man's right flower.
I can never remember which one it is.
Whatever one got his head cut off. It's that one, and Mel Brooks also plays the piss boy who carries around a bucket that everyone pisses into. And that is also a little funny to me. But I just like the word piss, so...
Yeah.
But other than that, this segment is also terrible.
There's a few things I like about the film. I like the cavemen masturbating themselves to death. I like it when the skits are 4 to 5 minutes apart, or 4 to 5 minutes apiece, and you get some jokes in there, and then we move on to the next. That's what I thought this whole film was going to be.
Yeah.
Just small vignettes instead of full half-hour narratives.
And it's sort of like he didn't... It felt like they were just making this movie up as they went along.
Yes, it does.
Because, like, the first few segments, they all have that Orson Welles narration. Then, like...
He's gone.
Like, what, did he die while they were making this, maybe? I don't know, but it's like...
There's a scene where Gregory Hines is being seduced, and his tongue rolls out of his mouth, and it's enormous and disgusting looking. I thought that was a little funny.
It's just the
most part, it stinks. This movie sucks.
It's all, like, dad jokes. It's just those jokes that, like... I found it interesting that when the three of us were talking about this movie in general, that we all had memories of this movie just being the movie that was always just playing in the background somewhere at like family functions.
Yeah.
You know what's weird? Like, I can remember playing in the background and catching glimpses of the TV, and none of those memories in my head were anything in the movie.
Really?
You were probably watching a different movie.
A lot of the problem with this film is it's mostly... These actors mugging for the camera.
Oh, God, yes.
And every time they tell a joke, the goddamn camera pans to somebody for a reaction shot.
Stop.
And it is just taxing.
And it's weird because, in general, most of these people are funny. Like, half of them were in Young Frankenstein, and they were all great.
Yeah.
In this, they're just... They're yucking
it
up.
Horrendous. Yeah, that's it. They're yucking it up.
Yeah.
They're cracking each other up.
Yeah.
They're twisting their faces into these strange reaction shots. And it's like, why would I want to see this? This is not good.
It's also painful that this movie exists in a world where you have Monty Python.
Right.
Like, who do it so much
better. They do pretty much everything in this movie a million times better.
Yeah. There's nothing absurdist about this film.
No.
Which I think made Young Frankenstein funny. There's absurdities in that.
It's just...
Why is Igor in a brain depository?
Yeah.
That's an absurd thing. None of this is absurd. It's just hacky.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, there's a black guy. I bet he has a big dick.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
Exactly. And that's a joke. That's one of the jokes
that keeps happening over and over again.
Over and over.
Also be improvising, for the record.
Just cut it out. And it goes on and on. This movie never ends.
Yeah.
I've said all I have to say about this movie. That was my JFK.
I didn't like that.
That didn't sound anything like JFK. Thanks.
All right. I guess, is that it?
Yeah, I guess we don't have a lot to...
That was our
I hate it. I hated this movie, and I really like Mel Brooks.
We should have picked Spaceballs.
We should have picked any other Mel Brooks film. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for picking this.
All right. I guess we'll move on to recommendations.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah, I figured we'd make it like a fighting theme.
Yeah.
Show.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah. All right. So who wants to go first?
Not me.
I won't do it.
I'll recommend this fighting movie.
Oh.
It's not. I'm going to recommend a movie from 2011 that is on Netflix. You can watch it if you'd like to. Directed by J.C. Kandor. Is that how you say that?
Sure. Why not?
He just directed A Most Violent Year,
which I saw recently, and is phenomenal. It's very good.
Nice.
This movie's called Margin Call. It's about on the eve of the bubble
bursting.
Yeah, the Lehman Brothers meltdown. This is a fictional Lehman Brothers. Like, everything's fictional so that they don't get sued.
The bubble brothers. I botched that one.
Good work.
Let me get this big league chew out of my mouth.
But it's essentially about two analysts who, after everyone clocks out for the night, it's like 6 p.m. and this one guy's still there and he's kind of like going over some charts and realizes in that moment that within the next 24 hours, the entire country is going to go bankrupt. So it's insanely tense, but it all just deals with financial stuff, which is phenomenal. Like,
does it all take place over the course of one night?
Yes. That's 24 hours.
This is my movie.
It's sort of like a modern Glengarry Glen
Ross.
This
is my movie.
Yeah. Okay. Have you seen it?
I have seen it.
Did you like it?
I did like it. Yeah. It has a great
I'm
going to
watch this instead of eat Thanksgiving dinner with my family.
It has a great... It's character actor heaven. Like, Kevin Spacey is in it.
Zachary Quinto plays the main character. Stanley Tucci's in it.
Jeremy Irons is in it, too, I think.
Oh, wow.
Stanley Tucci's in it.
Yeah.
Good, I was waiting for it.
But it's great. And then... So I watched this last year, right before we started the site, and it sent me on this spiral of watching financial documentaries to the point where I was convinced like the whole thing was coming down, and it had already happened 3 years before that. So. But this is a great movie. I love it.
All right.
Doesn't get enough love.
Yeah,
what's it called?
Margin Call.
What year?
2011.
Yeah, it's kind of like just underloved, this film. It should be more known.
I know of it. I just never watched it, but I will. It's going in my queue.
That line made me laugh too.
Me too.
Actually,
it's one of my favorites of the film.
I'll go. No one minds.
Sure.
So Mike Nichols died during the week, and so I'm gonna pick 2004's Closer, directed by Mike Nichols.
Good pick.
So this was based on a play by Patrick Marber, and it stars Julia Roberts, Jude Law, Natalie Portman, and Clive Owen, and they're the four leads. It's basically just about relationships and sex and just characters just stabbing each other in the back over relationships
it's
and sex.
Brutal fucking
this is
movie.
A brutal movie. This is a brutal movie, but it's... And I'm not going to say nothing happens in the movie, but it's really just people in rooms talking. But
being awful to one another.
Yeah, but it's so... And the only weak part of this film is Julia Roberts, who I just generally don't think she's that great of an actress. And I think she's wrong for this film. But everyone else is Clive Owen in particular is very good in this movie. And Natalie Portman is also very good. And it's just it's like an actor's film. It's all about kind of like Foxcatcher, where it's just all about the performances. And
this is the movie that made me really like Clive Owen.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
I was wondering, why are you in a movie like Shoot 'Em Up? What are you doing?
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Oh my God, I forgot about that movie.
It's sort of like I'd seen him in a bunch of movies before this, and I was always just like, oh, he's just there. But in this, he's so good in this film.
I wouldn't have even been disappointed if he were the Bond that they chose.
Yeah, he would have been
Craig.
A good Bond. And, I mean, there's not a lot to say about this movie just because it's you have to just see it to experience it. But it's one of those. A lot of times when people adapt plays to the screen, it doesn't work because plays are by their nature just people talking. But Mike Nichols was such a good director that it has just this cinematic feel to it. He's able to direct it and Mike Nichols directed a lot of plays in his life, so he knew how to tackle both mediums.
He's a great director.
He was a great director, and I feel like this film's sort of like forgotten about. Like, I feel like when it came out, people talked about it a lot, but I don't hear people talking about it that much anymore.
It kind of like filled that gap of depressing relationship movie until Blue Valentine came out.
Yeah,
and kind of until something else comes out after that, because there's always that movie where you're like, oh, I want to stay away from that.
I feel like this movie kind of got brushed under the carpet due to Natalie Portman overdose at the time. She was in everything.
Oh,
you know,
I think maybe she really overdosed. I was like, I don't remember that.
I don't know. You know, during this time, she was in everything. She was in V for Vendetta.
Yeah,
she was in the
the Star.
This was a huge cast at the time this movie came out. Like yes. Jude Law was popping.
Yeah, yeah, the original J Law.
Mm-hmm.
And he's good in this too. I mean, everyone but Julia Roberts is really good in this. But
I think that's another point against it.
Yeah,
Julia Roberts.
Yeah, she just
presence.
I don't buy her saying this. There's a lot of people saying cunt in this movie, and I don't buy Julia Roberts saying that. It yeah. just seems
it's also not a fun date movie. So
no, yeah,
that's a great yeah, first date movie.
Yeah, this is the movie that's anti-love. If you like love, you will not like this movie. Yeah. But it's a good movie. 2004 is Closer.
Move that miserable piece of shit.
Okay, my pick is a film that came out this year. It's a Polish film, directed by Paul Polakowski.
Oh, is it about the screen door submarine?
No, no, it's not.
All right,
it's about screwing in a light bulb.
Yeah, it stars three men. This is a film that came out this year. It's called Ida. It stars Agata Kulesza and boy, am I going to ruin
Jeff,
this.
You're making this film up, aren't you?
And no, we reviewed this.
The other star is Agata Trebukowska.
Oh, there's two Agatas in this film? Popular name.
And it's really a two-woman show. There's other actors in it, but it's really about these two women. The synopsis is...
Oh, I have heard of this. Sorry, yeah.
Anna, a young would-be nun in 1960s Poland, is on the verge of taking her vows when she discovers a dark family secret dating back to the years of Nazi occupation.
Uh-oh.
And this is a hell of a movie. It's about 82 minutes long. It's short. It's a Polish language. It's black and white. And it's gorgeous looking. This director,
I heard great things when it came out.
Oh my goodness.
I think they just added this to Netflix.
It just got released, yeah. I think, last week. So go watch it.
Into the list it goes.
Yeah.
The queue.
Into the queue.
They call it a list now.
It's black and white, but it is a gorgeous modern looking film. The way he frames everything. Oh, the framing's just a thing of beauty, but... the story itself is so brutal. It's about this woman who's going to be a nun, and her family was killed during the war, but not by the Nazis. And so she goes, the Mother Superior says, before you take your vows, you have one living relative that you don't know about. You should go see her, and then if you're ready to take your vows after seeing her, you can come back.
Was
and
it
take
Dracula?
Your vows. Yes, her one relative is Nosferatu. It's Count Orlok.
Man, now I really want to see this.
That would be kind of fucking great.
It's the great Max Schreck.
Is he dead and loving it?
Oh, Jesus. So, yeah, it's a beautiful film, great performances. Agata Kulesza is especially great as... Ida's, that's her real name, her aunt, who is one of the judges. I believe it's kind of hinted that she was a Nuremberg judge.
Ooh.
And she's all messed up because she sent people to death. It's a wonderful film. I can't...
Sounds like a laugh riot.
No, there's no laughs to be had, but it not only is the story great, the acting's great, and it looks amazing. So 2004 is Ida.
Cutburn right. Film gave it a 7 out of 10.
I didn't reveal it.
Oh.
Well.
Gonna turn that down so you can hear us talk.
That's our show for this week.
So what do we got coming up next week? Oh, well, next week we're off for the annual eating of birds.
Yes, we'll be eating a turkey for the entire week. So we won't be able to podcast next week.
Yeah, so you'll get a best of episode, I believe.
We're going to be watching...
The best of Ted Danson, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
All his hits, Becker, Cheers.
Getting Even with Dad.
We got them all.
Chris, before you watch Lord of the Rings on Thanksgiving, I have a secret to tell you.
Okay.
I'm the last of the Dúnedain.
I don't know what that means.
Well, why don't you get out? I don't like this joke at all. It sucks.
Are you scared? Well, you should be.
Don't know what's happening, but hey, this week we got reviews for The Imitation Game, Horrible Bosses 2. Don't everybody get excited at once.
Yeah, Thanksgiving week's going to be a little light, folks.
Yes, light in the loafers.
Yeah. Mm.
We will have stuff every day, though.
Yes, we will.
Because God forbid we take a day off for real.
It's just of lesser quality.
Yeah.
And, I'm just kidding. It's great quality writing. I wrote two of them myself.
And then, when we come back, we're going to be talking about Dracula Dead and Loving It, because there's something wrong with us.
Yes.
As we wrap up our Mel Brooks director series.
We haven't had enough flogging from Mel Brooks, so we chose his... Is this his last film?
I think it's his, yeah, his okay. most recent film.
His last and possibly his least film, Dracula Dead and Loving.
I don't know. It would be hard to top this one.
Starring Leslie Nielsen. Well, this doesn't look promising. I'm going to tell you that right now. So, plugs. We got plugs. Cutprintfilm.com. Taste the staleness. Facebook.com.
You're throwing shade. It's getting dark in here.
Facebook.com/cutprintfilm. Why don't you be our friends? At cutprintfilm on Twitter.
Damn.
Tweet us. Hi.
Someone's professional today.
Hi. What type of meats and cheeses do you like? I
Go
don't know.
Go to Joystick Jerks.
Oh. Yeah, joystickjerks.com. They have a podcast about video games.
Go to joyridejerks.com. They talk about all the Joyride films featuring the character Rusty Nail.
Go to antifanboy.com for all your pleasure and needs.
Yes, they also do video games, but they, if I'm not mistaken, they do comic books and graphic novels.
They also talk about the film Joyride.
Oh, okay. Well then. That's about it. That's all we got this week.
Do you have a problem with me, Jeff?
Oh, wait, Chris, do you have a book? You want to plug your book?
Yeah, I do. It's called The House on Creep Street. Look for it up on Amazon. And I hope everyone has a good Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gobble, gobble, gobble.
Just plant fish around the corn, and then it'll grow good. You learn that.
Plant fish?
Yeah.
Oof. I'd like to take your face apart with my bare hands.